Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio. If we can hold on just a second, we've got another show going on at the same time. There we go. So this is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio. I am here in Willow, Alaska, the mushing capital of the world, and on the line we have Alex Stein. He is the writer and director of Mush the Movie. Alex, how's it going this evening?
It's going great, Robert. How are things up in Willow?
Well, you know, I haven't had a whole lot of time to digest what's going on the Iditarod today. My son and I, Tyler, we have been shoulder deep in snow figuring out what we're going to do with Hugh's drop dogs, Hugh Neff. We have four of his dogs here right now that flew in this morning, and we've got quite a bit of work ahead of us in the next day or so with digging out all this snow to incorporate all these extra dogs.
Wow. Excellent. So, again, just a review for people. When the dogs are dropped on the trail, they are they're dropped off at a checkpoint, and then they're flown back to Anchorage, and then the musher or a representative of the musher picks them up in back of the Millennium Hotel to take them back home, or in your case, take them back to your home.
Exactly. And it's a pretty ongoing process. They drop them 24, or they come into the Millennium 24 hours a day, and they'll call you in the middle of the night and say, you got a couple hours to come and get them. So we have to have the phones ready and ready to rock and roll. And I'm about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours on a bad day down to Anchorage. So it has been back and forth quite a bit for us in terms of making sure everything works out well. And the reason I mention all this is a lot of people don't understand that there's a heck of a lot of behind-the-scenes work for the mushers. Of course, with me working with Hugh Neff, and just about everybody else has a crew of handlers or helpers or volunteers that help them out, and we got to give some kudos to those guys for sure.
Absolutely, and you know, the entire race could not run without the active participation of thousands of volunteers. And while some of them are people who work directly with the mushers, there are also several thousand volunteers from literally all over the world who fly into Alaska to help out the Iditarod and to work and in Anchorage at the start and the restart and going on up the trail. And that includes a team of several dozen volunteer veterinarians who are at all of the checkpoints giving well over I believe 5,000 on-trail examinations of the dogs as they run up and down the Iditarod.
You know, Alex, this is my first time doing the dropped dog thing, and I was surprised when the dogs came in. They all came in with instructions, and some of them even came in with some medicine that was given to them by the veterinarians. One of them had some antibiotic type stuff. He had a sore foot, and then another one came in with some pain medication for some sore feet. So they're not just examining these dogs, they're also treating them and prescribing meds and the whole nine yards out there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and even when they get to Anchorage, the Iditarod staff and the volunteers who take care of the dogs until they can be picked up are highly trained. And they really, if you ever have a chance during the Iditarod to go back behind the Millennium, if there are dogs there, you can see the type of tender, loving care that they're getting. And the volunteers are all very, very excited to be there with the dogs. And a lot of times, you know, we sometimes forget that dogs are pack animals, and especially Iditarod dogs. They're used to being with their team and with their musher. And for them to suddenly be taken out of that environment and put on an airplane and then sent back to Anchorage, it can be a bit of a shock to the system. And these volunteers really make sure that that they do everything possible to make sure that the dogs are very, very well taken care of.
That's exactly right. So we are in day 7 of our Iditarod coverage, and the guys have been on the trail pretty much for a week now. The ceremonial start happened at last Saturday, and then, of course, the restart happened on Sunday. So we're in our 7th full day of mushing in the 2012 Iditarod. And as it stands right now, Ali Zirkel is still in first place as of 6:35 Alaska time. She is on her way away from Caltech. She left at 4:55 Alaska time. Then we have John Baker in second, Mitch Seavey, Aaron Burmeister, Dallas Seavey, Jeff King, Jake Berkowitz, Peter Kaiser, Ray Reddington, and Didi Genro round out the top 10. But what is surprising, Alex, is it looks like all the way down to the top 30, with the exception of Paul Gephardt and Rick Swenson, and they may be doing it right now, everybody has taken their 8-hour and their 24-hour mandatory rests. So this is when we're going to start seeing some real racing going on. The real strategy is going to come into play, and when we're going to see the real leaders and followers in this race very quickly.
Yeah, and it's a very, very exciting race. Usually by this time, there have been there's a lot more separation between the leader and the, you know, the followers who are still in the top 10. But as of right now, Ali Zirkel obviously is in front, and she is the first one out of Caltag. But there's a pretty sizable pack of racers who are all very, very strong and have very strong teams that are pretty much not very far behind her. So although it's very exciting, and Ali obviously is a big fan favorite, there is a lot of racing that's going to go on between here and Nome.
Exactly right. And I was talking to my friend this morning about where people are standing. He's been involved in mushing for the last 20 years, and his wife is the communications director for the Iditarod. And he was saying that, you know, don't start counting anybody out. The real race starts at about Unalakleet, and that's where you're really going to start to see the people either start to really pull ahead or those fall back a little bit.
Absolutely. And the race along the Yukon River, which is where the bulk of the pack is right now, we have 52 dog teams on the Yukon River, which is kind of an astonishing number. I don't know what the statistics are for how many there were last year, but it seems to me, I don't remember there being nearly this many all on the Yukon. And the Yukon River is known to be an area where the temperatures tend to drop a lot of the time. And really, you get a lot of racers are challenged to adopt or change their strategies and to just have to work a lot harder to make sure that their teams and they themselves are getting enough rest and enough fortification so that they can keep going and keep racing.
Right. And, you know, yesterday, I'm just looking here down at the standings, Alex. Yesterday, we profiled Josh Kadzow on our show. It was his birthday, and we talked about him being a rookie musher and all that. And he is currently in 21st place, it looks like. But the key is he only has 9 dogs. I know was he the one that started with 12?
I don't believe he started with 16, but I'm not sure if he started with 12.
Well, he is down to 9 at Nualto, which is kind of surprising. A nine-dog team with, I don't know, maybe 400 miles of the race to go, it can be a big issue in terms of your strategy if you have to drop one or if a dog gets hurt or as you're thinking about your planning on your way down the river and onto the coast. 9 dogs, that's a tough amount of dogs to take the rest of the way to Nome.
Absolutely. And although a lot of mushers report that the race gets a lot faster when they get onto the Bering Coast and they get past Unalakleet and move up towards that final push towards Nome. Some of the racers have lighter sleds shipped into Unalakleet so that they can, for the last part, have faster and lightweight, more lightweight sleds. So it is certainly doable to go in this far from the finish with only nine dogs. But as you mentioned, it puts more of a challenge on him, and he's got to, if you have 13 or 14 dogs and you have one dog who is underperforming, it's not that big a deal to drop that dog. If you only have nine dogs and one of the dogs is underperforming, then that could really put your race in jeopardy.
Speaking of putting races in jeopardy, we just lost another musher today, fan favorite Zoya Denure. She races primarily a kennel of rescue dogs. She's scratched and crippled this afternoon, or actually this morning, but I got the report this afternoon as a press release. But she dropped out of the race in response to her dog team. I guess they were not performing well, not eating well. We don't have the exact specifics, but she dropped out. But the interesting thing is a story or a report that came out this morning about Lance Mackey, four-time in a row champion. He didn't win last year. He had some problems on the trail, but he's a big fan favorite, always has been. What can you share about Lance Mackey and what he said this morning?
Yeah, Lance Mackey, in an interview with APRN, said that he had 10 dogs, but because of their performance, it was more like he only had 7 dogs. His lead dog, Maple, entered the race in heat, and he's had problems with the other dogs being more interested in mating with Maple, the male dogs, than running down the trail. He said that he's got a bunch of minor injuries to his dogs. There is one dog he reported was shedding toenails and only had one toenail left. He said that every one of his runs was taking about a half hour longer than it really should have taken him. And as fans might remember, Lance Mackey, when he had his string of 4 Iditarod victories, had a lead dog named Larry. And there's been a lot of talk today about how lead dogs really are the glue that holds the entire team together. And if you look at the mushers who've put together multiple victories, oftentimes it's behind the same lead dog. So Jeff King had a bunch of victories with the same lead dog and Susan Butcher, and Lance Mackey, of course, with Larry. And there is a feeling that Lance Mackey needs to find another really great leader, if he's going to really come back and dominate the sport the way he once did.
Yeah, that's a good point. And a lot of people try to wonder why folks do so well for a group of years. You talked about Susan Butcher and Lance Mackey and Doug Swingley in the early 2000s, who had several years of Iditarod championships. And Iditarod racing, or mushing in general, is almost like a 5-year cycle. The time the dogs are raised up, and a typical Iditarod dog on a championship team is typically 2 or 3 years old, and then they have a racing career of 5 or 6 years. That's why you're seeing these strings of very good wins or championships or finishes, because of the group of dogs that are of age. And then when those dogs retire and get out of the team, it takes that much longer to raise up another championship team. So that, I think that's what you're seeing with Lance this year and last. He's lost a lot of those premier dogs he had during that 4-year streak, and now he's raising up another bunch of dogs. So pay attention to him, of course, always, but in the next year or two, he will be a force to be reckoned with again.
Yeah, and Lance has in the past described Larry as a once-in-a-lifetime type of dog. And when you have these really phenomenal leaders, they can take a musher from being a good musher to being a dominant musher who is always going to be coming in the top 3 or the top 5. And once you don't have that dog anymore, it can be very, very difficult to get yourself back into that top group of finishers, because as great as the other dogs are, sometimes without the proper leader, it just can be very, very difficult.
Right, and that is actually the topic for today on Mushing Radio. Make sure you follow us on Facebook, DogWorks Radio, as well as Twitter. Alex is at Coldfoot Films. That is his Twitter handle, very active on Twitter, and myself at DogWorks Radio or Robert Forto. Make sure you like our page, like I said, at DogWorks Radio on Facebook. But we're going to talk today about dog positions, and we already talked a little bit about the lead dogs and how they are prominent in the team. And then I'm just going to run down how a team is set up for our new musher or new fans to mushing. And then, of course, anybody that knows much about the sport knows exactly what I'm talking about. The first dogs in the team are, of course, the lead dogs. Most people these days run a pair of lead dogs in tandem. Typically, a mushing gang line is set up in tandem of two dogs. Very seldom do you see a musher these days running with one dog, but typically one dog is getting the press or, you know, the fan favorite, as you will, as you talked about, Larry, Alex. Right behind those guys are the swing dogs. Typically those are dogs that are in training for lead. They can lead in a pinch. They could be backup leaders, but those guys are the ones that are swinging the team. They're the ones that are listening, in quotes, to the leaders. Following those dogs from their back is a group of dogs called team dogs, and that can be anywhere from 6 to 10 dogs, pairs of dogs there if you're running a 16-dog team. And at the very back of the team, right in front of the sled next to the musher, are your wheel dogs. The wheel dogs, you can think about those guys as the offensive linemen of the dog team. They're usually the brutes of the team, the bigger dogs, the dogs with all the muscle. Those are the dogs that have the majority of the pressure in terms of weight on their hips and on their backs. So what I want to mention is what I heard John Baker speak about this past fall. He said, somebody asked him, do you always keep your dogs in one position or do you switch them around, you know, training leaders, you know, during the year and whatnot? And his response was he puts a dog in position and he leaves them there. That is their position throughout their racing life, is if they're a leader or they're swing dogs or team dogs or wheel dogs, he doesn't switch them around. Kind of the predominant way of thinking in mushing is most of us will train as many dogs that we possibly can as lead dogs. So therefore, if a lead dog goes down or he has to be dropped for whatever reason, or he doesn't pull, or he pulls in a particular condition, we like to be able to switch our dogs around in lead position. I think that's probably the more way of thinking, at least these days, in terms of running a dog team. Alex, what do you want to share about that?
You know, I have in talking to mushers, John Baker's strategy is certainly very unusual from what I can tell. But of course, he won the race last year, so clearly it does work for him. Most mushers, it seems, will at least switch several dogs in and out of lead, perhaps giving a dog that they think might be able to lead a chance to be in lead position for a relatively easy part of the trail, and then if it doesn't work out, they can always switch the dog back. One thing that I'm wondering about the with the wheel dogs is, have you noticed in your mushing career and in talking to other mushers, do wheel dogs generally have as long a racing career as the other dogs?
Well, unlike John Baker, I switch my dogs around all the time. Of course, I have a core group of bigger, stronger, larger dogs that I will run and lead most often, or in wheel position most often. But I'm prone to switching them all around all the time. Very seldom do you find the same dogs in wheel all the time. But I think so. I would tend to agree that if you just use that offensive lineman type analogy, you know, those big brutes guys that are playing football, they have bad knees and bad hips and bad backs and all that because of the amount of stress and strain that they have on their bodies. So that's the main reason I'm switching them out. And I think, again, that's the predominant way of thinking in mushing today, is to switch them in and out throughout the team. Maybe not in lead, so to speak, but definitely throughout the team.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I would imagine as a musher, you would want to have more than two dogs who could run lead, just in case you had something where both of your dogs running lead had to be dropped.
Right.
You wouldn't want that to just ruin your race.
That's exactly right. And on a typical, I typically run a 12-dog team in training, and most often we have four or five very strong leaders that we could put up there at any time. And that's, again, very typical with the teams today. If a dog, goes down or isn't pulling quite right, or, he's pulling back a little bit in terms of speed, we can always just switch them around. And some dogs, especially young dogs, get a little intimidated by conditions and the trail, so we want to switch them out occasionally. And that's very typical for dogs to be switched around. And if we could talk a little bit about the Yukon Quest, and I'm not sure exactly, I'm sure it's very similar in Iditarod, I just don't know the name of the award, but in the Yukon Quest, the other 1,000-mile race, they offer a golden harness award for the lead dogs, or the best dog, the MVP dog, so to speak, and it's typically given to a lead dog, and they get a special golden harness and all that. Do you know what that award is called in the Iditarod, Alex?
I'm not in the Yukon Quest or in the Iditarod?
In the Iditarod. I know they have an award like that. I just don't know what it's called.
I believe it's also called the Golden Harness.
Okay. So, and when you talked about Larry with Lance's dog and Marble and all of those guys have their very special dogs that they praise about, if you will. I know Hugh Neff talked a heck of a lot during his Yukon Quest win this past February about Walter and Juanita, and Walter got a heck of a lot of press from that race. I mean, that's his go-to main leader on his team. So everybody has one. I just don't know enough about all the teams to talk about them. And one other point I would like to make about the dog teams is, we mentioned John Baker and how he keeps all of his dogs in a particular position during their lives. And he said in that same talk, he is not overly affectionate with his dogs. He knows that they know who the leader is, and they know, when it's time for business. So he says he doesn't do a lot of kissing and loving and all that stuff with his dogs. It's more of, hey, let's go to work, boys. It's time to get it done. Whereas you'll hear a lot of mushers are very affectionate with their dogs, spend a lot of time with them, cuddling and petting and grooming and preening and all that. We talked about how he won with the dogs in one position. He won that same race without being overly affectionate. I know you've spent a lot of time with mushers. What is the the theory behind that? Do you have any information about that?
Well, I think that a lot of mushers try to spend as much time with the dog so that they can really establish that kind of shorthand. And dogs are... And I'm sure we could spend an entire show talking about this, but dogs are incredibly intuitive. And a musher who's been working very closely with dogs, often they will seem to be able to read each other's minds. A lot of mushers report that before they can issue a command, a G or a haw, the dog will already sense what they're going to say and start moving in that direction. Lance
right.
Mackey is maybe the best example of this. He rather famously spends a lot of time with his dogs and often even sleeps with them out in the dog yard. And Lance has an unbelievable rapport with his dogs. And he's said on many occasions about his various dogs that they would literally go to the ends of the earth for him.
Exactly.
And that does not seem to be all that unusual. Most of the mushers that I've talked to are very, very affectionate with their dogs, but they also know that, and the dogs know that when it's time to go to work, that they can just take charge, and they are the alpha, and the dogs will listen to them.
That's exactly right. You can, a musher can never spend too much time with their dog, and it doesn't always have to be on the back of the sled or on the runners of the sled. It can just be time out there in the dog yard, you know, setting up that bond, making sure that bond is very well established well before the race starts. The true bonding occurs during the springtime and the fall, when you're out there just working with those dogs and doing those chores and hanging out with the dogs. I know Martin Booser does a heck of a lot of free running with the puppies and raising them from before birth to be good sled dogs. Martin Booser is probably the preeminent dog trainer in terms of Iditarod mushers. He could spend hour upon hour talking about the appropriate way to raise sled dogs, and of course he knows exactly what he's talking about. He has several Iditarod championships under his belt.
Yeah, and I just wanted to briefly mention that bond and that communication and that shorthand really goes both ways. And experienced mushers who've worked with the same dogs will know that at some times the dogs will be a little bit hesitant or will not want to go in one direction or will sense that there is a danger ahead before the musher can see it or can be aware of it. And good mushers, experienced mushers, learn how to read and listen to their dogs when the dogs are communicating something to them on the trail as well.
Exactly right. So we're going to head on into the next segment of our show. We want to talk about what we've come to call our featured musher of Mushing Radio. Each night we talk about one particular musher. Typically it's not one of the front runners. It's not one of the guys that everybody knows about or is rooting for. We talked about Josh Kadzow last night, and the night before we talked about Karen Hendrickson. And tonight we're going to talk about Hank DeBruin. He is a Siberian Husky musher from Halliburton, Ontario, Canada. So he is a Canadian musher, and he's running a team of purebred Siberians. And I know you spent some time with him and spoke with him during the making of your film, Mush the Movie. What do you know about Hank?
Well, Hank it's very interesting. The two Siberian teams, which is Hank DeBruin's and Karen Ramstead's, have spent most of the race traveling together. So if you see, you know, a whole bunch of Siberian Huskies together, that's the two of them. They're currently in Ruby. It looks like they are both taking their eight-hour mandatory Yukon River rest in Ruby. They're in 51st and 52nd place. So you know, not in the front of the pack, but not the last mushers either. Hank is officially a rookie in the race, which can be a little bit confusing to some people because Hank ran the Iditarod in 2010, but he had to scratch. Under Iditarod rules, you're still considered a rookie until you complete the race, until you finish in Nome. So even though this is Hank's second time running the race, second time starting the race, he hasn't finished yet. So he doesn't have his belt buckle and he's still considered a rookie. He's from Ontario, Canada, which is sort of the other side of the country from where a lot of Canadian mushers are from, and he got a Siberian Husky about 16 years ago, and he and his wife became fascinated with the Iditarod after reading Libby Riddle's book Race Across Alaska, which is about the first time a woman, Libby Riddles, won the Iditarod, and it's basically kind of her Iditarod diary for that year. It's a really good read if people haven't read it. And they moved 10 years ago out of the city and started a dog sled touring company so that they could start a kennel and have some money coming in and start working with dogs. They now have well over 100 dogs, and they have a staff that works with them giving sled dog tours all winter. And Hank, people often talk about the mushers that have mentored them and that have worked with them when they were just starting out. And Hank said that because of where he lived, his his mentors were really people who were doing it long distance, people who he was watching from afar and reading about and watching videos of, people like Rick Swenson and Libby Riddles and Dee Dee Genro and Martin Boozer, and the people who we always think about when we think about who are the real ambassadors for the sport. And Hank relied on them in terms of looking at how to approach being a musher and going for his Iditarod.
Can you share a little bit of the story? I know that's very controversial, what happened in 2010. I wrote a little article about that on my website, about the Rule 36. I know we were going to talk about that in one of these shows, but you know what, Alex? We're running out of time. Front runner should be in Nome on, I would say, Tuesday or so. So we only have a few more days before the folks start coming in to Nome. What can you tell us about that Rule 36, or what happened to Hank out there on the trail?
Yeah, the Rule 36 specifies when mushers have to be at certain checkpoints in order to be considered competitive. And Hank was running a slower race, and although he was keeping with his allotted schedule, he was a little bit behind where he was supposed to be and was asked to scratch, or else, I believe he was asked to scratch, or else he would have been withdrawn from the race. And that is certainly a heartbreaking thing to have happen to you as a musher. You never want to be at the receiving end of that phone call where the race marshal tells you that you have to pull out. It's a little bit controversial in that there are these guidelines for how fast your race has to go, but there also is some wiggle room and some room for the race marshal to take into account other factors such as how fast you're going, what the condition of the dog team is, various things like that. So it is a little bit, it is not as objective as it perhaps could be. It's a little bit subjective. And frankly, I think that being the race marshal who has to make those kind of calls is really a thankless job, because nobody is going to be happy with you no matter what you decide.
Exactly. And I don't think that's going to happen this year. In 62nd place and right above her in 61st is Bob Klupach and Jan Steves. They're in Ophir right now. So they're making their way down the trail. They appear to be competitive, so to speak, in terms of that Rule 36. And we talk about Rule 36, of course, that's the Iditarod official rules for the race and for the mushers, and that's the rule that pertains to competitiveness. And you can find out more about that on their website at iditarod.com. And then, of course, you have several people in front of Bob and Jan in Cripple. You have Pat Moon and Mike Supernat and Jamie Kinzer, I believe how you pronounce it, Kirk Barnum, and rookie mount Matt Failer, I believe is how you pronounce that. And, of course, Dan Seavey, the eldest of the Seavey group, is in 60th place in Cripple as well. So we appear to have a group of mushers this year that nobody is really falling behind or is out there by himself, so to speak. And that's a good thing, isn't it, Alex?
It's absolutely a good thing. And having someone like Dan Seavey, who ran the very first Iditarod and who is considered, you know, an elder statesman of the race and someone who provides a link back to the very earliest Iditarod, is something that is really exciting, I think, for a lot of fans of the race.
Right, exactly. So what else? We have a few more minutes. I had scheduled 45 minutes today since we are doing this at our other studio. You're calling in from California. I'm here at the house. What else do you want to mention today? We have a few minutes left.
Okay. Well, I want to just give a quick shout out to Todd Hausman, who's one of our Twitter buddies, and he just wrote in and said Pat Moon was the one who started with 12 dogs,
okay.
Not Josh. So thanks, Todd. It looks like Josh did start with all 16 dogs. So for him to be down to 9 is a pretty serious thing at this point. So tonight it's going to get very cold on the Yukon. It's supposed to go down to 22 below zero in Unalakleet. So along the trail, it's going to be, I think, considerably colder than it has been. That's going to make it a little bit tough for a lot of the teams that are on the Yukon right now. And there are, as we said, 52 of them on the Yukon. At the front of the pack, Jeff King has been making very, very fast runs. So Jeff King, who is behind Ali Zirkel right now, of course, Jeff is a four-time Iditarod champion. He is absolutely not someone to be written off. And in fact, you could say the same thing of pretty much everyone in the top 12 or 15 racers. There is a lot of real experience and a lot of talent, a lot of great, great dog teams that are looking very good. People have been talking on Twitter and on Facebook about Mitch Seavey's team seems to be slowing down a little bit. He's still in third place, and he came into Caltech just a minute behind John Baker. Ali Zirkel is about 3 hours ahead of them, and so it still is looking like it's going to be a very, very exciting race. And of course, once we get to the Bering Sea, then it becomes an entirely different race where people are trying to fight off the wind. It's frequently very, very windy in that portion, and looking to fine-tune their race strategy to get to Nome as fast as they can.
And Alex, we've talked a lot about on this show about the mandatory rest, the mandatory eights and the mandatory 24s. A mandatory 24 at some point during the race, it doesn't matter where a musher takes that, it's often part of their race schedule or their race strategy. And then they have a mandatory eight somewhere on the Yukon River, and most of the teams have taken that. But there's also a mandatory 8 hour rest at White Mountain. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, White Mountain is, and I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it is just about more or less 100 miles from the finish in Nome. And I am not positive. I do not believe that this mandatory rest was always part of the race. I think it's a relatively recent thing to be introduced. And I believe part of the reason that this was introduced was to make sure that in mushers' desires to just get the race through and to push forward to Nome, that they didn't overtax their dog teams. So there is a mandatory rest at White Mountain that all mushers have to observe, and then it's just a 100-mile run into Nome. So that kind of is a way to make sure that the mushers are a little bit more alert and that the dog teams are a little bit more well-rested, just to make sure that there aren't any mistakes that are made by the mushers because they're too fatigued or any serious injuries that might happen to the dog teams in that final push towards the finish.
And I want to make sure that we cover some of the wild stories that happen at the last checkpoint in the race towards Nome at safety. Hopefully we can talk about that tomorrow as well. I know you have a story that you had shared with me before, and I think a lot of fans and listeners would like to hear about some of the crazy things that mushers have done in safety, just a short run from there to Nome. So we'll try to cover that as well tomorrow. Alex, a couple more minutes left. Who do you want to cover tomorrow, and what is going to be our topic? Do you have a particular topic that we want to talk about unless something major develops?
Well, I think tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit about the northern versus the southern route, which is, as we know, in the even years, after Ophir, I believe it is, the race goes north. That's the route we're on right now that goes through Cripple and Ruby and then all the way to Caltag. In the odd years, it goes south through the ghost town of Iditarod and then joins back up to Caltech. So we're going to talk a little bit tomorrow about the northern versus southern routes, what the mushers think of them, whether there's one that's easier. Of course, as we know, easy is a relative term in anything Iditarod. And then I don't have selected a musher to cover for tomorrow, but we are certainly open to anyone's suggestion. If you have a particular musher that you want us to cover, please let us know on Facebook or on Twitter.
And make sure you head over to that Facebook page and hit that like button, and you will be entered to win a copy of Alex's movie, Mush the Movie. We're giving out an advanced copy before it's released to the public or on sale to the public. So make sure you like that page, and we're picking a random winner every day. We've been doing so throughout our coverage here. But also keep the conversation alive there on DogWorks Radio or on any Twitter feed. If you're just following on Twitter, make sure you enter that hashtag, and hashtags are everywhere these days. Hit hashtag Iditarod or Iditarod40, and Alex and I pay pretty close attention to that using our Twitter feeds, and we'll answer any questions that come up. And you know, the coverage isn't over. You can always go to that Insider, and I know Iditablog does a podcast. I don't know if they're doing live podcasts every day, but they've done them right after us, haven't they, Alex?
Yeah, they have. I don't think they do one every day, but they do one at least every other day. And they have some great information there as well. I did try to start a fake Twitter feud with them, but I guess I gave up on that because it was fake. But we love those guys, and they have a staff that is up and going up and down the trail, and they've had some great interviews, and absolutely check out that the Anchorage Daily News. Kyle Hopkins has some great stuff from the trail and the Alaska Dispatch, and we try to share as much of this stuff with you as possible on Twitter and on Facebook. And if there's something that you guys come up with, please let us know, and we'd be happy to pass it along as well.
So, Alex, we've been doing this for a week now, pretty sudden that we talked about doing it. How do you think it's being perceived, at least our show, Mushing Radio, mushingradio.com? We've had quite a few conversations on Twitter and Facebook. What do you think the gist is of our show?
You know, I think people are enjoying our show because it gives them a chance to get a little bit of an insider view of the Iditarod, and it lets us go into a few topics in more depth. And I think people also appreciate the fact that in addition to covering what's going on at the front of the race, which is frankly what gets the most of the attention, that we're also talking about what's happening in the middle and what's happening at the end.
Right. So make sure you give us your comments and concerns, guys. We're definitely interested in hearing from you, and we'll talk about it. If you bring up a topic and we have the time to do it, we'll definitely research it if we can and talk about it on the next show. So, Alex, it's been a pleasure. We will definitely talk again tomorrow, same time, 6:30 p.m. Alaska time, 10:30 p.m. on the East Coast, and it will be podcasted and available immediately after this show. As soon as I get it loaded up and rocking and rolling on that, you can listen to it anytime. So it's been a pleasure, Alex. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
You're welcome. And this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio, mushingradio.com. On Monday night, we will be back in the radio studio on KVRF 89.5 FM in Palmer. And again, we always stream live there as well as podcast on mushingradio.com. So we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.